The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Marshall Matters with me, Winston Marshall at The Spectator in London. Today I'm joined by esteemed historian Neil Ferguson, and I think many, if not all, listeners and viewers will already be familiar with your work as a historian, author of the books Empire, How Britain Made the Modern World, Colossus, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire, Civilization, your biography of Henry Kissinger, The Square and the Tower, and most recently, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Neil's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute and the senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. And as a journalist, he is a columnist for Bloomberg.com. And it is with Bloomberg.com that he published his piece, The Aliens Have Landed and We Created Them, which is the topic of our conversation today. Neil, thank you so much for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Winston.
So I want to get into AI, as I said. You published this piece with Bloomberg.com. The subtitle is The Cassandras Are Out in Force, Claiming Artificial Intelligence Will Be the End of Mankind. They have a very good point. And this is in response to Eliezer Yudkowsky's piece for Time magazine, which was following off the back of the petition signed by various, though not all, people in the AI industry, if it's an industry, calling for a six-month moratorium halting the development of AI. So, before getting into your piece, I wondered if you might tell me why you're interested in AI, just to set a bit of a background into you coming into writing the piece.
Well, Doom, my most recent book, has a section towards the end in which I ask about the various ways in which we as a species can be offed. And although people talk a lot about climate change, that doesn't seem to me like the most efficient way of getting rid of humanity. Nuclear war would do a better job much faster. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, what other technological innovations might lead to the destruction of Homo sapiens? Now, I came across Eliezer Yudkowsky's work when I was researching Doom, and he was one of those people who suggested that there was a non-trivial risk that artificial general intelligence, if you could create that, would go after us. This is the kind of Skynet scenario from the Terminator movies. I'm not entirely a subscriber to that view. I have a somewhat different take on the threat posed by large language models. And that's what the piece really does. It doesn't go with Yudkowsky all the way to they're out to kill us. My argument is that if you think about the potential applications of large language models in politics, these will be an even more potent tool for polarization and the spreading of disinformation than social networks and social media were back in 2016. Mm-hmm. And so we should be very uneasy about the speed with which large language models are being rolled out so near to a US election. And I was very struck as I did my homework for the piece by the fact that the proponents of more or less unrestrained development of artificial intelligence, like my old friend Reid Hoffman, don't really seem to address that issue. And they should, because after all, it's pretty much the same people that gave you the social networks online. And I don't think any of them could really claim today that that didn't have a major political downside. Mm-hmm. So I do wonder why we're not discussing much more urgently the potential use of AI in American politics.
That I actually have is the aspect I understand, because, and I'd like to put a pin in Yudkowsky and the real, because he says it's the end of humanity.
Yeah, I mean, he says essentially if you create an intelligence that's superior to human intelligence, it will wipe us out. And it's a bit like, I don't know if you've read Liu Cixin's book, The Dark Forest, which is the sequel to The Three-Body Problem. But in that, he argues that if there's any superior intelligence, in the universe, it will if it discovers us, it will immediately eradicate us, just in case we might eradicate it. And that dark forest theory is kind of what Yudkowsky is saying. That's why the headline was, you know, the aliens are here and we created them. If you think of artificial intelligence as non-human intelligence, which would be a much better thing to call it, I think artificial intelligence sounds a little bit harmless, but if you called it non-human or inhuman intelligence, then you'd recognize that you're creating aliens within. And I think the Yudkowsky argument is, if you create an intelligence superior to ours, we should expect to be eradicated. I don't think that's right.
I think really struggle with that argument, because there's a jump in faith there that he assumes that they then would act on their own accord, which that jump in the doomsday is, I don't see how AI can suddenly decide to act. I can see, and it's like at this point it's a cliche, the paperclip maximizer idea, where you give it one task and in so doing it wipes out humanity in the meantime
by mistake.
And in your article you talk about maybe climate change being an example of that. How do we deal with climate change? Okay, the AI decides, let's get rid of humanity. There's a big jump there which doesn't quite add up for me, and I haven't followed Yudkowsky entirely. And so in fact he is there's a interview he's done recently with Lex Fridman earlier this year. He borderline breaks down into, he's on the verge of tears. He is so certain this is the end of humanity. But so you don't agree that it is?
No, I don't. And I don't think it's I don't think it's convincing that that would automatically follow that dark forest theory applies to human-created artificial intelligence systems. My point is that these are incredibly powerful tools that can be used to cause even more pandemonium in our societies than social media have caused so far. But there's another point. I read on my way here a headline, US legislators say AI should not be put in control of nuclear weapons. And that gets to the heart of a really important point about AI in its potential military applications. If you read the book that Eric Schmidt did with Henry Kissinger on AI, one of the most striking passages is about the way an artificial intelligence would approach warfare. And it would approach it in a different way from humans, just in the same way that it approaches chess in a different way from humans, with likely very non-human decisions. If you empower AI to make battlefield decisions, in effect to give it the trigger, then that would be highly dangerous. Now, it's reassuring to hear that American legislators don't want this to happen. And I think there is already some kind of self-denying ordinance at the Pentagon not to have unintermediated AI decision-making, i.e. the kill switch will still be in human hands. But there's no international convention to that effect, and there's nothing to stop, say, China from having AI-enabled weapons systems making far more rapid decisions about targeting and attacking than our systems. So we have a major problem when you think about the military applications. In effect, private sector actors are developing the next generation of weapons. In marked contrast to, say, mid-20th century innovation, in which the Manhattan Project was a government enterprise. It's a little bit as if nuclear weapons were being invented by Boeing and General Motors in the mid-20th century rather than by the US government. There's an arms race at the moment in large language models and other AI, but it's not so much between the US and China. It's really between a handful of companies, of which Google and Microsoft are probably the furthest out there. But Amazon and Facebook can't be entirely out of this, to say nothing of Apple. Meanwhile, in China, you've got a couple of companies, maybe three, that can do this, have the compute power to do it. That arms race is going to produce, with very high probability, unintended consequences, not only in the military domain, but also in the domain of medical science. AI is hugely powerful for medical scientific research. That's clear. Look at AlphaFold, one of DeepMind's greatest achievements to date, maybe Demis Hassabis' greatest achievement. But there are other ways in which AI in the realm of biotech could be very dangerous indeed. Biological weapons and chemical weapons were outlawed by conventions reached in the 20th century, but How are we to say if those conventions will be adhered to? The Soviet Union didn't, in fact, adhere to them. So I worry a lot about how AI can not only potentially control weapon systems, including nuclear weapon systems, but also how AI can become involved in a new era of biological warfare research. That would be really dangerous.
Putting on your sci-fi hat, could you kind of give an example of how you think that AI will affect geopolitics? Like, play that out a little bit for
me. Well, I don't think you need to do sci-fi. I mean, I am, as readers of Doom will know, a believer that one should read science fiction, and that it's very difficult as an historian to think about the future without some science fiction in your head, because ultimately history will tell you a lot, because the nature of power doesn't change, but it won't really give you a clue about the unintended and intended consequences of technological innovation. And science fiction is quite good at making you alive to that. I'm a big devotee not only of Lucy Shin, but of Neal Stephenson, whose books everyone should know. Everyone should have read Snow Crash and Cryptonomicon. These are extremely important books. So I don't think one needs to be as good as Lucy Shin and Neal Stephenson to do this. I think you just need to ask yourself, what are the lessons of the war in Ukraine? The lesson of the war in Ukraine is that very accurate targeting and precision weaponry mean very high casualties in conflict. Mm-hmm. That's the distinguishing feature of this war. They really high percentages of both sides that get killed. And that's all to do with targeting and the accuracy of the weapons. So it's not difficult to see that you could simply take an AI and empower it to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. And it would do it faster than humans. It's quite a slow process, even with the technology that the Ukrainians have at their disposal, to collate all the information. I mean, you're getting information from multiple sources, which is essentially adding up to a spatial identification of where Russian forces are, Russian assets are. And then you decide to hit them. Well, AI can definitely do that faster than humans. But do you want war to be waged at that tempo? That would be my question. Because it clearly would be even more destructive and really, really hard to stop. It would be war at an unprecedented speed, mm-hmm. with the obvious risk of escalation, mm-hmm. That I think would certainly be present in the case of a war over Taiwan. I mean, there are limits on the escalation that can happen, I think, in the case of the war in Ukraine. It's a little less obvious what the limits are in the case of a US-China war over Taiwan. So I don't think that's science fiction. I think that's very much in the present day and within the reach of the existing technologies.
So back to the petition then, assuming then that these other geopolitical forces, other nations, are all thinking about AI just as much as Western nations are, and they aren't going to put a halt to development of AI, what is the point in this petition to stop it? And can it really have an effect? Do you really think there'll be a moratorium on it?
I don't think there will be. I think if I were not at OpenAI, I would probably, if I were at a rival company trying to develop AI, particularly if I wanted it to be of commercial value, I'd really want a moratorium on OpenAI, because OpenAI is kind of suddenly ahead of the field.
It's because of the large language model.
Because I think they just let ChatGPT loose and took everybody by surprise by doing that. And so I think a lot of the argument that's going on for a moratorium is really just the other tech companies saying, can we catch up? Uh-huh. So I don't take that too seriously. Nor even if it were entirely altruistic, do I think it's likely that a bunch of private sector actors will reach some kind of a moratorium. The only actors that can do this are governments. Now, we know governments can agree to freeze particular technologies because biological weapons were outlawed by a convention that went into force when Richard Nixon was president. And I think that was important. Although we know the Soviets cheated, it was far from easy for them to produce covertly biological weapons. We want to make it difficult to produce AI systems that are lethal to humans. That seems obvious. I don't really see a reason why we aren't negotiating an international convention to limit their use in war right now. Mm-hmm. And I think the US and China in particular need to be talking about that, because it's certainly not going to be figured out by Elon on the phone to Sam Altman.
This sort of goes back now to a point you made earlier in the conversation, which is the most pressing, which I think I agree with you, is the most pressing concern about AI and AGI, or rather AI is the LLMs and ChatGPT, and how it might affect, let's say, an election as it's coming up. And I had a little toy around with ChatGPT, and it turns out it didn't mind questions, pertinent questions about Jesus Christ, but it did not like pertinent questions about the Prophet Muhammad, nor about his youngest wife. So it was my experience, and users can have a go themselves, that it's already internalized Islamic blasphemy laws, and I've also seen examples of how it's treating Trump differently from Biden. It's sort of unstoppable at this point how ChatGPT could influence an election, and my experience is that there's human forces behind it that it would allow me to question Jesus Christ, but not the Prophet Muhammad. That's not happening in AI. That's a human that's behind it, that's affecting it. So are we going to have a similar issue of humans behind at the company OpenAI, like we had at Twitter, of trying to manipulate things, and we saw the Twitter files? Is that a serious concern? Is there anything that can be done about that?
Well, you're not the only person to run these experiments to see if it has a political agenda. Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of people have, and it's clear that that ChatGPT is about as woke as Silicon Valley is generally. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's too surprising. If you remember a few years back, Microsoft tried out a chatbot, the name of which now escapes me, but this was 8 or so years ago. And because they hadn't built in any of those controls, it very quickly started to spout wild and sometimes right-wing as well as downright obscene language. And so they clearly didn't want that to happen again. So what do? Well, you create some kind of filters to make sure that when it's trawling or scraping all the websites in the world, it doesn't do too much scraping in MAGA world. It doesn't do too much scraping in the far right areas. And I think that's what's going on. They're basically making sure that ChatGPT doesn't scrape content that would offend woke sensibilities. I don't think there are imams sitting there at OpenAI. I think this is just the kind of thing that's been going on at Google and at the other big tech companies for some time. I think that's concerning for a couple of reasons. One is that there is a kind of powerful feedback at work where essentially large language models are doing an elaborate form of word prediction on the basis of a vast sample size of phrases and sentences. And of course, it starts to feed off itself, because the more content is generated by AI, the more AI-generated content the AI has to feed off. Reid Hoffman just wrote a book, half of the text is by GPT-4. I can anticipate a great flood of AI-generated text in the coming years. And so you get this feedback loop. Once you've set these parameters, the flood of new AI-generated text will ensure that those parameters become self-reinforcing. Mm-hmm. The second concern is that if, as I suspect, it becomes a source of content for election purposes, that is to say, fake content or skewed content, to say nothing of all the deepfake videos, I think this will have an even bigger impact than social media tools did in 2016 and in 2020. In 2016, they were kind of left at Trump's disposal. Most obviously, Facebook ads were. And in 2020, the tech companies did whatever they could to make it harder for Trump. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a big deal. I mean, the most important democracy in the world gets to vote every 4 years. And with every passing iteration of technology, there are shifts in the playing field, and level it ain't.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing you go into a little bit in your piece, which I think could have seismic impact, not just on society, but on politics as well, which is how it will affect the jobs market and particularly white collar jobs. And you make the point that it's AI can't still make write a biography about Kissinger because it can't read all that you wrote about it. But surely if you scanned everything that you read to prepare for the Kissinger book into an AI languaging model system, it could do the work. And so actually it'll change the world forever if it can do everything that historians, writers are doing, all analysts, everything's, all white collar work is over.
Well, there are two things. First, I mean, the case of my particular line of work, a lot of important documents are very, very hard to read. For example, it would be very difficult for AI to take on the Rothschild history that I wrote, 20 or so years ago, because so much of the material was in an almost indecipherable Judendeutsch, German and Hebrew characters. Even material relating to the life of Kissinger is practically illegible where it's handwritten, for example, his parents' letters. You probably could get some character recognition solutions there, but the key point is that the access to the materials is limited. AI is learning off open source internet content. The problem for the Chinese companies is there's much, much less of that in Chinese. But the archives that I have been working on are not open, and so the AI can't access them.
Sure, but
in fact, only a few researchers can. So that means I don't get put out of a job, at least in the remaining years of my life. But that's obviously not of enormous importance to listeners. It's of enormous importance to me, Winston. The key,
with all due respect,
the key issue...
Brilliant as you are... And at this point, AI has not quite met Neil Ferguson's level intelligence. But when we hit the singularity, we will be at that point. And all you have to do is put it in the right direction, yeah, and it will do the work for you.
Well, at times I wish it were now, and then I could relax and instead of getting up at 4 every morning to write this damn book. But the key point is that most predictions about the employment consequences of new technology are wrong historically. So Sam Altman, 7 years ago, when I first met him, predicted with absolute confidence that within 5 years, i.e. by 2021, all trucks in the United States would be self-driving and all the truck drivers would be learning to code, presumably living on the streets of San Francisco. Well, I can confirm that the trucks in the United States are still driven by people and there are very few unemployed truck drivers. In fact, there's a shortage of truck drivers. So one has to be very careful about making predictions of large-scale unemployment. The handloom weaver's story is one that's often been told. It was told by Keynes back in the 1930s. There have been numerous predictions of mass unemployment through technological innovations and they haven't materialized. Because there are other forms of work created by the new technologies. And there are a lot of things that AI will take ages to be able to do. I mean, maybe it'll get to be able to drive cars at some point. But well before we get to the singularity, you have to solve a lot of very complex problems to produce a robot capable of delivering elderly care or being an effective primary school teacher. I think we're a long way off from that. And as our societies age, more and more of the workforce will be engaged in caring for the elderly. I don't think robots are doing that anytime soon. So although it's clear that a lot of white-collar jobs, particularly low-level legal or accounting jobs, are going to be destroyed, that's happening already because the large language models are very efficient tools for lawyers dealing with vast amounts of very boring text, all in an accessible computer-readable form. That's happening, but I don't think it means that there'll be like 30% unemployment and truck drivers and legal clerks roaming the streets starving. That, I think, is highly unlikely.
I wondered if you might indulge me in a bit of... I mean, this is perhaps political philosophy, perhaps theology, but the Yudkowsky article that you endorsed says at one point, and I want to read this because...
Hang on, I didn't endorse it. I quoted it, then disagreed with it, just to be clear.
Right, okay. Well, so you may disagree with this then. Yudkowsky writes, "I'd be remiss in my moral duties as a human if I did not also mention that we have no idea how to determine whether AI systems are aware of themselves, since we have no idea how to decode anything that goes on in the giant inscrutable arrays. And therefore, we may at some point inadvertently create digital minds which are truly conscious and ought to have rights and shouldn't be owned." So I wondered whether you, Neil, think that we get to a point where AI and computers and robots ought to have rights, maybe in parity with human beings?
Well, I don't think we'll get to that point anytime soon for the reason I gave you. The robots are a long way off from being as good at faking humanity as these large language models can fake human text. So that's a distant problem. It's one that science fiction writers have grappled with. You know, should the replicants have rights? That's the central question of Blade Runner, which of course derives from Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I think that we have a much more imminent struggle over animal rights to get through before anybody starts debating AI rights.
But they're linked, I think. Tom Shivers does this well in his book, The AI Aren't Don't Hate You, or something like that. I think that's the name of the book. But a lot of the people, and I'm sure you've met these people in California, a lot of the people behind this the AI tech thing, it's a rationalist atheist movement. And there's weird stuff, it's kind of culty that I've heard, and I met some of these people, and there's like polyamorous aspects to it, and it's a bit bizarre, but crucially, a lot of them are rationalist atheists. And that this is even a question that they might have rights, or that animals might have rights, isn't, let's say, a question for me as a Christian. Like that in a metaphysical sense, no, we go back to scripture, and that's not even something we have to worry about. But that's where it's, I think, linked, is do animals have rights? Do robots have rights? Because it just goes down to consciousness and sentience. Are we even different to them? So where do you stand on that?
Well, I think we've already accepted that animals have animal rights, not human rights, but they have some rights. Otherwise, we wouldn't have laws that protect them from cruelty. I think with large language models, the question doesn't really arise. It'll arise when there are human-like robots, and then people will start to raise these questions, and they won't be able to answer them because their brains will have been entirely wiped clean of philosophical and ethical content by the masters of Silicon Valley. I think there is something very suspicious and unnerving about that curious ideological convergence of the things that you alluded to. In addition, we should mention the quest for immortality, which is a great preoccupation of the lords of the valley. The dangers of this kind of thinking were well illustrated by the case of Sam Bankman-Fried, the great crypto fraud. I think if you are taught these things at a young age, you probably will get completely decoupled from the ethics of not just of Christianity, but of any major religion. So I find all of this repugnant and don't want to live forever, have no desire to become a cyborg, and certainly don't intend to grant rights to human-like robots. But as I said, part of the point of large language models is that they will populate the internet with AI-generated text, which will be very good at faking humanity. Remember, the critical thing about AI is it's not human. It should really be called non-human intelligence, not quite artificial intelligence or inhuman intelligence, because we have to remember it's not at all like our intelligence. It's faking it. And what's most alarming to me is how excitedly humanity embraced ChatGPT. Euphorically, it was addictive. And what we were really being mesmerized by was essentially computer programs pretending to be human and doing it convincingly enough for some people at least to be fooled. That's disturbing, because the real point about AI is precisely that it's not human. It's just pretending to be human. Its real defining characteristics are revealed by the way it plays chess, which is like an alien playing chess. That should, I think, make us aware of the fact that it's an alien intelligence that's been called into being here. And this much of Yudkowsky's argument I buy, that as it becomes more intelligent than us, as its computational power exceeds our own, it is likely to behave in alien, non-human ways. What we have to worry about is not replicants that are indistinguishable, almost indistinguishable from humans. We have to worry about robots with an entirely alien intelligence that currently we're intent on building. Now, that we should worry about.
Can I just pick you back up on your point about finding it repugnant, the transhuman stuff? Because presumably you have a line there. Mary Harrington makes an argument that the first transhuman technology was the contraceptive pill, and so maybe you find all that the pill itself repugnant because where are you on the line then between here and living forever? That where do you draw the line of repugnancy?
Oh, in the soggy center.
Okay.
You know, you're not going to get me to adopt Roman Catholic positions on contraception. No way. No, I mean, I think there's a kind of rather good compromise that has worked, that has evolved in. With respect to birth control, it's constantly going to be contested, but I think we've actually arrived at a modus vivendi, if that's not the inappropriate phrase, and we should be relieved that we've done that. Yeah. Because in a counterfactual world without birth control, I don't think we'd be very pleased at the spectacle.
Neil, I'll ask you one last question, if I may. In your book, Civilization, you argue that Samuel Huntington was wrong, that the future of conflict will be between civilizations, and rather it will be intra-civilizational, and there's some reason to see now, as the geopolitics are today, you might be right, although we might be in a cold war with China, so perhaps he's right. But I wondered then, with the advent of AI, how your argument might have changed, if you might revise that position, if the robots are the new enemy. How does that affect your thought?
Well, right now, AI is, from a geopolitical point of view, a tool in the armory or toolkit of two superpowers and nobody else, because only the United States and China has companies capable of this kind of innovation. And as I mentioned earlier, it's probably best to think of a Cold War framework and to see this as the latest feature of the arms race that characterizes Cold Wars. I think the Huntington hypothesis has been repeatedly falsified if one looks at the hot wars of modern times. And my argument that most of the conflicts would be within civilizations is looking pretty good. Overwhelmingly, the wars that have happened since Huntington published that essay have been within civilizations. And take a look at Ukraine. It would be, of course, lovely to believe that there's some profound difference between Ukrainians and Russians, and to some extent there is, in the sense that not all Ukrainians are Orthodox and not all of them speak Russian. But really, if one visits Ukraine, if one knows the part of Russia that adjoins it, the striking feature is many things they have in common. I mean, I know there are some differences between Ukrainians and Russians, but really, the truth is that this is a war between two very similar peoples. And the Ukrainians are having to kind of learn Ukrainian to make themselves less Russian as part of the building of their nation. The narcissism of small differences propels much more conflict than civilizations clash. And part of the point of a Cold War is that it's not really a clash. A Cold War is a peace that is no peace. That was George Orwell's term. That's what the US and China currently have. And I'll believe Huntington was right if there's a hot war between the United States and China. But right now, that's not my base case, because that would be so catastrophic, even without artificial intelligence to help it along.
Great. Well, Neil, thank you so much for speaking with me today. Fascinating. I'm sure listeners would have loved that.
Thanks, Winston.